At this point, William's focus drifted to a hill which overlooked the entire scene. Another individual was looking down on the battle. He was dressed in buckskins and led a pack mule, a mountain man. He turned from the battle and walked down the hill in the opposite direction, past the pool and falls, then out of sight. I was astounded. The battle took place right here in the valley, just south of the falls. When my attention returned to Williams, he was reliving the horror of the bloodshed and the hatred. He knew his failure to act during the Native American Wars had set up the conditions and hopes of his most recent life. But just as before, he had failed to take action, failed to awaken. He had been together again with a large man who had been killed with a woman missionary. And Williams knew that he was supposed to remember first, and then help his younger friend to awaken. He saw them standing together on a hill, discussing the process. They were supposed to find five others in the valley, forming a group of seven. Together, the group was to help resolve the fear. The idea seemed to thrust him into a deeper recollection. Fear had been the great enemy throughout humanity's long and tortuous history. And he seemed to know that present human culture was polarizing, giving the controllers in this historical time one last opportunity to seize power, to exploit the new technologies for their own purpose. He seemed to cringe in agony. He knew that it was tremendously important for his group to come together, regardless of whether he could be there. History was poised for such groups, and only if enough of them formed, and only if enough of them understood the fear, could the polarization be dispelled and the experiments in the valley ended. Very slowly I became aware that I was again in the place of soft white light. William's visions had ended, and both he and the other entities had quickly vanished. Afterward, I had experienced a quick movement backward that had left me dizzy and distracted. I noticed Will beside me to the right. "What happened?" I asked. "Where did he go?" "I'm not sure," he replied. "What was happening to him?" "He was experiencing a life review."
"Are you aware of what that is?" he asked.
"Yeah," I said. "I know that people who have had near-death experiences often report that their whole lives flash before them. Is that what you mean?" "Yes, but the increased awareness of this review process is having a great impact on human culture. It's another part of the higher perspective provided by knowledge of the afterlife. Thousands of people have had near-death experiences, and as their stories are shared and talked about, the reality of the life review is becoming part of our cultural reality. This knowledge is contributing to our determination to pursue every intuitive image that comes to mind and keep it firmly in awareness. We're living life in a more deliberate way. We don't want to miss a single important event. We don't want the pain of looking back later and realizing that we blew it, that we failed to make the right decisions or actions." Suddenly, Will paused and cocked his head as though hearing something. Immediately, I felt another jolt in my solar plexus and heard the dissonant hum again. Moments later, the sound faded. Will was looking around. The solid white environment was shimmering with intermittent streaks of dull gray. "Whatever is going on is affecting this dimension, too," he said. "I don't know if we can maintain our vibration." As we waited, the dull streaks gradually diminished, and the solid white background returned. "Remember the warning about new technology and the ninth insight," Will added, "and what William said about those in fear of trying to control this technology." "What about this group of seven coming back?" I asked. "And those visions that Williams was having of this valley in the 19th century?"
"Will, I've seen them too."
"What do you think that means?" Will's expression grew more serious. "I think all this is what we're supposed to be seeing. And I think you are part of this group." Suddenly the hum began to increase again. "Williams said we first had to understand this fear," Will stressed, "in order to help resolve it." "That's what we have to do next. We have to find a way to understand this fear." Will had barely finished his thought when an ear-shattering sound tore through my body, pushing me backward. Will reached out for me, his face distorted and out of focus. I tried to grab his arm, but he was suddenly gone, and I was falling downward, out of control, amid a panorama of colors. Shaking off the vertigo, I became aware that I was back at the falls. Across from me, under a rocky overhang, was my pack, lying exactly where I had placed it earlier. I looked around. No sign of Will. What had happened? Where did he go? According to my watch, less than an hour had passed since Will and I had entered the other dimension. And as I thought about my experience, I was struck with how much love and calm I had felt, and how little anxiety, until now. Now everything around me seemed dull and muted. Wearily, I walked over and picked up my pack, fear welling up in my stomach. Sensing too much exposure in the openness of the rocks, I decided to walk back into the hills to the south until I could decide what to do. When I had crested the first hill and started down the slope, I spotted a small man, perhaps 50 years old, walking up to my left. He had red hair and a thin goatee and wore hiking clothes. Before I could hide, he spotted me and headed straight my way. When he reached me, he smiled cautiously and said, "I'm afraid I'm turned around a bit. Could you direct me back to town?" I gave him the general direction south to the spring and then on to the main stream, which he could follow west to the ranger station. He appeared relieved. "I ran into someone east of here earlier who told me how to get back, but I must have made a wrong turn. Are you also heading toward town?" Looking closely at the expression on his face, I seemed to pick up a sadness and anger in his personality. "I don't think so," I said. "I'm looking for a friend who's out here somewhere. What did the person you met look like?" "It was a woman with blonde hair and bright eyes," he replied. "I didn't catch your name." "As friendly as possible," I said. "It sounds as if the person you met could have been my friend. Where did you see her exactly?" He pointed toward the south and told me he had run into her about half a mile back. She had been walking alone and had headed southeast from there. "I'll walk with you as far as the spring," I said. I picked up my pack, and as we walked down the hill, he asked, "If that was your friend, where did you think she was going?" "I don't know." "Into some mystical space, perhaps, looking for utopia?" He was smiling cynically. I realized he was baiting me. "Maybe," I said. "Don't you believe in the possibility of utopia?" "No, of course not. It's Neolithic thinking, naive." I glanced at him, fatigue beginning to overwhelm me, trying to end the conversation. "Just a difference of opinion, I guess." He laughed. "No, it's a fact. There's no utopia coming. Everything's getting worse out there, not better. Economically, things are swinging out of control, and eventually it will explode."
"Why do you say that?"
"It's simple demographics. For most of this century, there's been a large middle class in the Western countries, a class who have promoted order and reason and carried a general faith that the economic system could work for everyone. But this faith is beginning to collapse now. You can see it everywhere. Fewer people every day now believe in the system or play by the rules. And it's all because the middle class is shrinking. Technological development is making labor valueless and splitting human culture into two groups, the haves and the have-nots, those who have investments and ownership in the economy and those who are restricted to menial service jobs. Couple this with the failure of education, and you can see the scope of the problem." I stopped on the crest of one of the hills to view the impending sunset, and our eyes met. He seemed to realize he had gotten carried away with his tirade. And in that moment, he began to look deeply familiar to me. I told him my name, and he responded with his, Joel Lipscomb. We looked at each other for another long moment, but he offered no indication that he knew me. Why had we met in this valley? As soon as I had formulated that last question in my mind, I knew the answer. He was voicing the vision of fear that Williams had mentioned.
A chill ran through me. This was supposed to happen. I looked at him with a new seriousness.
Do you really think things are that bad?
Yes, absolutely, he replied. I'm a journalist, and you can see this attitude playing out in our profession. In the past, we at least attempted to do our job with certain standards of integrity. But no longer. It's all hype and sensationalism. No one's looking for the truth anymore, or trying to present it in the most accurate way. Journalists are looking for the scoop, the most outrageous perspective, every bit of dirt they can dig up. Pretty soon all these subtle assumptions and agreements that hold civilization together will be totally subverted. Think what will happen once unemployment gets to a certain level in the inner cities. Crime's out of control now. What's going to stop it? He paused, and I glanced back at him as we walked. I guess you think some spiritual renaissance is going to change all this, he asked. I sure hope so. He struggled over a fallen tree to catch up with me. Listen, he continued, I bought into this spirituality stuff for a while, this idea of purpose and destiny and insights. I could even see some interesting coincidences happening in my own life. But I decided it was all crazy. The human mind can imagine all sorts of silly things. We don't even realize we're doing it. When you get right down to it, all this talk of spirituality is just weird rhetoric. I started to counter his argument, but changed my mind. My intuition was to hear him out first. Yeah, I said, I guess it sometimes sounds that way. You probably think something mystical is happening here in this valley, and why not? Everyone would love for there to be something mystical going on in existence, especially considering the diminishing quality of life. But the fact is, there's nothing going on. We're just animals, creatures unlucky enough and smart enough to have figured out we're alive, and we're going to die without ever knowing any purpose. We can pretend all we want, and we can wish all we want, but that basic existential fact remains. We can't know. I looked back at him again. Don't you believe in any kind of spirituality? He laughed. If a god exists, he must be an exceedingly cruel monster of a god. There couldn't be a spiritual reality operating here. How could there be? Look at the world. What kind of god would design such a devastating place where children die horribly by earthquakes and senseless crimes and starvation when restaurants toss out tons of food every day? Although, he added, perhaps that's the way it's supposed to be. Perhaps that's God's plan. Maybe the end times scholars are correct. They think life and history is all just a test of faith to see who will win salvation and who won't. A divine plan to destroy civilization in order to separate the believers from the wicked. He attempted a smile, but it quickly faded as he drifted into his own thoughts. Finally, he quickened his pace. We were entering the sage meadow again, and I could see the crow tree a quarter of a mile away. Do you know what these end times people really are saying believe is happening? I did a study of them several years ago. They're fascinating. Not really, I said, nodding for him to go on. They study the prophecies hidden in the Bible, especially in the book of Revelations. They believe that we live in what they call the last days, the time when all the prophecies will come true. Essentially what they think is this. History is now set up for the return of the Christ and the creation of the heavenly kingdom on earth. But before this can occur, the earth has to suffer a series of wars, natural disasters, and other apocalyptic events predicted in the scriptures. And they know every one of these predictions. So they spend their time watching world events very closely, waiting for the next event on the timetable.
What's the next event? I asked.
A peace treaty in the Middle East that will allow the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. Sometime after that, according to them, a massive rapture will begin among true believers, whoever they are, and they will be snatched off the face of the earth and lifted into heaven. I stopped and looked at him.
They think these people will begin to disappear.
Yeah, that's in the Bible. Then comes the tribulation, which is the 7-year period when all hell breaks loose for whoever is left on earth. Apparently, everything is expected to fall apart. And then a politician emerges, probably in Europe, who offers a plan to pull things back together. If, of course, he's set up with supreme power. This Antichrist at first protects Israel and facilitates a peace treaty. Then attacks later, starting a world war that ultimately involves the Islamic nations, including Russia, and finally China. According to the prophecies, just as Israel is about to fall, the angels of God swoop down and win the war, installing a spiritual utopia that lasts 1,000 years. He cleared his throat. Walk through a religious bookstore sometime and look around. There are commentaries and novels about these prophecies everywhere, and more coming out all the time.
Do you think these end-time scholars are correct?
He shook his head.
I don't think so. The only prophecy that is being played out in this world is man's greed and corruption.
We stopped and drank some water from my canteen. 50 yards ahead was the crow tree. I perked up. Far in the background, I could detect the faint dissonance of the hum. Joel's eyes squinted in concentration, watching me closely.
What are you hearing?
I turned around and faced him. It's a strange noise, a hum we've been perceiving. I think it may be some kind of an experiment going on in the valley.
I haven't heard anything about that. What kind of experiment? Who's conducting?
I was about to tell him more when we were interrupted by another sound. We listened carefully.
That's a vehicle, I said.
Two more gray jeeps were approaching from the west and heading toward us. We ran behind a patch of tall briars and hid, and they passed within 100 yards without stopping, heading southeast along the same path the earlier jeep had followed.
I don't like this, Joel said.
Who was that?
Well, it's not the Forest Service, and no one else is supposed to be driving in here.
I think it must be the people involved with the experiment.
He looked horrified.
If you want, I said, you can take a more direct route back to town. Just head southwest toward that ridge in the distance. You'll run into the stream after about 3/4 of a mile, and you can follow it west into town from there. I think you can arrive before it gets too dark.
You're not coming?
Not now. I'm going directly south to the stream and wait a while for my friend. He tensed his forehead. These people couldn't be conducting an experiment without someone in the Forest Service knowing about it.
I know.
You don't think you can do anything about this, do you? This is something big. I didn't respond. A pang of anxiety rushed through me. He listened for a moment and then moved past me into the valley, walking quickly. He looked back once and shook his head. I watched him walk until he crossed the meadow and disappeared into the forest on the other side. I hurriedly walked toward the south, thinking again of Charlene. What had she been doing out here? Where was she going? I had no answers. Pushing hard, I reached the stream in about 30 minutes. The sun was now completely hidden by a band of clouds at the western horizon, and the twilight cast the woods in ominous gray tones. I was tired and dirty, and I knew that listening to Joel and seeing the jeeps had affected my mood severely. Perhaps I had enough evidence now to go to the authorities. Perhaps that was the way I could help Charlene most. Several options danced through my head, all rationalizing my return to town. Because the woods on both sides of the stream were thin, I decided to wade across and make my way into the thicker forest on the other side, although I knew that area was private property. Once across, I stopped abruptly, hearing another jeep, then broke into a run. 50 feet ahead, the lane rose quickly into a knob of boulders and outcroppings, 20 feet high. Climbing quickly, I reached the top and accelerated my pace, then leaped upon a pile of large rocks, intending to jump them quickly to the other side. When my foot hit the topmost rock, the huge stone rolled forward, throwing my feet out from under me and starting the whole pile moving forward. I bounced once on my hip and landed in a small gully, the pile still tumbling my way. Several of the stones, each 2 or 3 feet in diameter, were careening down, coming squarely for my chest. I had time only to roll on my left side and raise my arms, but I knew I could not get out of the way in time.
Then, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a wispy movement of white in front of my face. Simultaneously, an unusual knowing came over me that the huge rocks would somehow miss. I heard them crash on both sides. Slowly, I opened my eyes and peered out through the dust, wiping the dirt and rock chips from my face. The rocks were lying neatly beside me. How had that happened? What was that white form? At the rising sound of the approaching vehicle, I jumped to my feet and ran several more steps before landing awkwardly on another rock. A bolt of throbbing pain raced through my whole leg as my left foot gave way. I fell to the ground and crawled the last 2 yards into the trees. I rolled around behind a huge oak as the vehicle pulled up to the stream, slowed for a few minutes, then raced away, again toward the southeast. My heart pounding, I sat up and pulled off my boot to inspect the ankle. It was already beginning to swell. Why this? I thought. As I slid around to stretch out my leg, I observed a woman staring at me from about 30 feet away. I froze as she walked toward me. Are you all right? She asked, her voice concerned but wary. She was a tall black woman, perhaps 40, dressed in loose-fitting sweatclothes and tennis shoes. At her temples, strands of dark hair had pulled out of her ponytail and dangled in the breeze above her temples. In her hand was a small green knapsack. I was sitting over there and saw you fall, she said. It's your lucky day. I'm a doctor. Do you want me to take a look? I'd appreciate that, I said, dizzily. She knelt down beside me and moved the foot gently, at the same time surveying the area toward the creek. Are you out here alone? I told her briefly about looking for Charlene, but left out everything else. She said she had seen no one of that description. As she talked, finally introducing herself as Maya Ponder, I became convinced that she was completely trustworthy. I told her my name and where I lived. When I finished, she said, I'm from Asheville, although I have a health center with a partner a few miles south of here. It's new. We also own 40 acres of the valley right here that joins the National Forest. She pointed to the area where we were sitting, and another 40 acres up the ridge to the south. I unzipped a pocket in my hiking pack and pulled out my canteen. Would you like some water? I asked. No, thanks. I have some. She reached inside her own pack, retrieved a canteen, and opened the top. But instead of drinking, she soaked a small towel and wrapped my foot, an action that made me grimace in pain. Turning and looking into my eyes, she said, You've definitely sprained this ankle. How badly? I asked. She hesitated. What do you think? I don't know. Let me try to walk on it. I attempted to stand, but she stopped me. Wait a minute, she said. Before you try to walk, analyze your attitude. How badly do you think you're hurt? What do you mean? I mean that very often your recuperation time depends on what you think, not me. I looked down at the ankle. I think it could be pretty bad. If it is, I'll have to get back to town somehow. What then? I don't know. If I can't walk, I may have to go find someone else to look for Charlene. Do you have any idea why this accident happened now? Not really. Well, what does that matter? Because, again, very often your attitude about why an accident or illness has happened has an effect on your recuperation. What kind of a doctor are you? I asked. She smiled, and for the first time I saw her energy lift. She had decided to trust me, too. Permit me to tell you about the kind of medicine I practice, she said. Medicine is changing, and changing rapidly. We don't think of the body as a machine anymore, with parts that eventually wear out and have to be fixed or replaced. We're beginning to understand that the health of the body is determined to a great degree by our mental processes. What we think of life, and especially of ourselves, both at the conscious
and unconscious levels. Adopting a positive outlook is very important in staying healthy, but we have to engage in this attitude in full awareness, using love for this attitude to be completely effective. What I believe is that our unspoken fears create blocks or crimps in the body's energy flow, and it's these blocks that ultimately result in problems. The fears keep manifesting in ever greater degrees until we deal with them. Physical problems are the last step. Ideally, these blocks would be dealt with early in a preventive way before illness develops.
So you think all illness can ultimately be prevented or cured?
Yes, I'm sure we will have longer or shorter lifespans. That's probably up to the Creator. But we don't have to be sick. And we don't have to be the victims of so many accidents.
Do you think this applies to an accident like my sprain, as well as to illnesses?
She smiled. Yes, in many cases.
I was confused. Look, I don't have time for this right now. I'm really worried about my friend.
I've got to do something.
I know,
but I have a hunch this conversation won't take long. If you rush by and disregard what I'm saying, you may miss the meaning of what is obviously quite a coincidence here.
She looked at me to see whether I had picked up on her reference to the manuscript.
You're aware of the insights?
I asked.
She nodded.
Well, what exactly do you suggest I do?
Well, the technique I've had great success with is this. First, we try to remember the nature of your thoughts just prior to the health problem, in your case, the sprain. What were you thinking? What is the fear this problem is revealing to you?
I thought for a moment, then said, I felt afraid, ambivalent. The situation here in this valley seemed much more sinister than I thought. I didn't feel as though I could handle it. On the other hand, I knew Charlene might need help. I was confused and torn over what to do.
So, you sprained your ankle.
I leaned toward her.
Are you saying that I sabotaged myself so I wouldn't have to take action?
Isn't that too simple?
That's for you to say, not for me. But very often it is simple. Besides, the most important thing is not to spend time defending or proving. Just play with it. Try to remember everything you can about where the health problem came from. Explore for yourself.
How do I do that?
You have to calm your mind and receive this information, intuitively, prayerfully, however you conceive the process.
I resisted again, not sure whether I could relax and clear my mind. Finally, I closed my eyes, and for a moment my thoughts ceased, but then a succession of memories of Will and the day's events intruded. I let them go by and cleared my mind again. Immediately I saw a scene of myself at age 10, limping away from a touch football game, well aware that I was faking the injury.
That's right, I thought. I used to fake sprains to avoid having to perform under pressure. I had forgotten all about this.
I realized that later I began to actually hurt the ankle frequently, in all kinds of situations. As I pondered the memory, another flash of recollection entered my mind, a cloudy scene of myself in another time, feeling cocky, confident, impulsive. Then, as I worked in a dark, candlelit room, the door crashed in, and I was dragged away in terror. I opened my eyes and looked at Maya.
Maybe I have something.
I shared the content of my childhood memory, but the other vision felt too vague to be described, so I didn't mention it. Afterward, Maya asked,
What do you think?
I don't know. The sprain seemed the result of pure chance. It's hard to imagine that the accident came from this need to avoid the situation. Besides, I've been in worse situations than this many times, and I didn't sprain the ankle. Why did it happen now?
She looked thoughtful. Who knows? Perhaps now is the time to see through the habit. Accidents, illness, healing, They're all more mysterious than any of us ever imagined.
I believe that we have an undiscovered ability to influence what happens to us in the future, including whether we are healthy. Although, again, the power has to remain with the individual patient.
She paused and poured more water on the towel around my ankle, then continued.
I believe the first step in the process is to identify the fear with which the medical problem seems to be connected. This opens up the energy block in your body to conscious healing. The next step is to pull in as much energy as possible and focus it at the exact location of the block.
I was about to ask how this was done, but she stopped me.
Go ahead and raise your energy level as much as you can.
Accepting her guidance, I began to observe the beauty around me and to concentrate on a spiritual connection within, evoking a heightened sensation of love. Gradually, the colors became more vivid, and everything in my awareness increased in presence. I could tell that she was raising her own energy at the same time. When I felt as though my vibration had increased as much as possible, I looked at her. She smiled back at me.
Okay, now you can focus the energy on the block.
How do I do that? I asked.
You use the pain. That's why it's there, to help you focus. How badly does it hurt right now?
It's a throbbing ache, but not too bad. She unwrapped the towel.
Focus your attention on the pain and try to feel it as much as possible. Determine its exact location.
I know where it is. It's in the ankle.
Yes, but the ankle is a large area. Where exactly?
I studied the throbbing. She was correct. I had been generalizing the pain to the whole ankle, but as my leg was stretched out with the toes of my foot pointed upward, the pain was more precisely centered in the top left portion of this joint, and about an inch inward.
Okay, I said. I've got that.
Now, place all your attention on that specific area. Be there with all of your being. For a few minutes, I said nothing. With total concentration, I felt this location in my ankle completely. I noticed that all the other perceptions of my body, breathing, the location of my hands and arms, sticky sweat on the back of my neck, faded far into the background.
What's happening with the pain? She asked.
It's still there, but it has changed in character or something. It's becoming warmer, less bothersome, more like a tingling. As I talked, the pain began to take on its normal sensation again.
What's happened? I asked.
I believe that pain serves another function beyond just telling us that something is wrong. Perhaps it also points out exactly where the difficulty is, so that we can follow it into our bodies like a beacon and place our attention and energy in exactly the right spot. It's almost as if both the pain and our concentrated attention can't occupy the same space. Of course, in cases of severe pain where concentration is impossible, we can use anesthetics to ease the intensity, although I think it's best to leave some pain so that the beacon effect can be utilized.
She paused and looked at me.
What's next? I asked.
Next, she replied, is to consciously send higher divine energy to the exact spot identified by the pain, intending that the love will transform the cells there into a state of perfect functioning.
I just stared.
Go ahead, she said. Get completely connected again. I'll guide you through it.
I nodded when I was ready.
Feel the pain with all your being, she began. And now begin to image your love energy going right into the heart of the pain, lifting that exact point of your body, the atoms themselves, into a higher vibration. See the particles take a quantum jump
into the pure energy pattern that is their optimum state. Literally, feel a tingling sensation in that spot as the vibration accelerates. After pausing for a full minute, she continued, "Now, without changing your focus on the point of the pain, begin to feel your energy, the tingle, moving up both legs, through your hips, into your abdomen and chest, and finally into your neck and head. Feel your whole body tingling with a higher vibration. See every organ operating at optimal efficiency." I followed her instructions exactly, and after a few moments, my whole body felt lighter, more energized. I held that state for about 10 minutes, then opened my eyes and looked at Maya. Using a flashlight in the darkness, Maya was putting up my tent on a flat area between two pines. Glancing over at me, she said, "Feel better?" I nodded. "Do you understand the process so far?" "I think so." "I sent energy into the pain." "Yes, but what we did earlier was just as important. You begin by looking at the meaning of the injury or illness, what its occurrence is pointing out about some fear in your life that is holding you back, manifesting in your body. This is what opens the fear block, so that the visualization can penetrate. After the block is open, then you can use pain as a beacon, raising the vibration in that area, and then in your entire body. But finding the origin of the fear is vitally important. When the origin of the illness or accident is very deep, it often requires hypnosis or intensive counseling." I looked at her for a moment, then said, "You mentioned that prayer works. How is the best way to pray for someone who's not well?" "We're still trying to figure that out. It has something to do with the eighth insight process of sending the energy and love that flows through us from the divine source to the person, and at the same time visualizing that the individual will remember what they really want to do with their life. Of course, sometimes what the person remembers is that it's time to make a transition to the other dimension. When that's the case, we have to accept it." Maya was finishing with the tent and added, "Also keep in mind that the procedures I've recommended should be done in conjunction with the very best in traditional medicine. If we were near my clinic, I would take you in for a full examination. But in this case, unless you disagree, I suggest you stay here tonight. It's better if you don't move too much." As I watched, she set up my stove, turned it on, and placed a boiler containing freeze-dried soup on the flame. "I'm going back into town. I need to get a splint for your ankle and some other supplies just in case we need them. Then I'll hike back out and check on you. I'll bring a radio, too, to use if we have to send for help." I nodded. She poured her canteen's water into mine and looked over at me. Behind her, the last streak of light was vanishing toward the west. "Did you say your clinic was near here?" I asked. "Actually, it's only about 4 miles to the south," she said, "over the ridge, but there's no way to come into the valley from that direction. The only pass is the main road that comes in south of town." "How did you happen to be here?" She smiled and looked slightly embarrassed. "It's funny. I had a dream last night about hiking into the valley again, and this morning I decided I would do just that. I've been working hard, and I guess I needed some time to reflect on what I'm doing at the clinic. My partner and I have a great deal of experience with alternative approaches, Chinese medicine, herbs. Yet at the same time, we have the resources of the world's best in traditional medicine at our fingertips through computer. I've dreamed about this kind of clinic for years." Standing up, she glanced at my ankle, then at me. "I'm leaving now," she said. "Try not to put any weight on your foot. What you need is complete rest. I'll be back in the morning." I think I must have looked anxious because she knelt down again and put both hands on the ankle. "Don't worry," she said. "With enough energy, there's nothing that can't be healed. Hatred, war. It's just a matter of coming together with the right vision." She patted my foot, gently. We can heal this. We can heal this.
She smiled once, then turned and walked away. I suddenly wanted to call out and tell her everything I had experienced in the other dimension and what I knew about the fear and about the group coming back. But instead, I remained quiet, fatigue overwhelming me, content to watch her disappear into the trees. Tomorrow would be soon enough, I thought, because I knew exactly who she was. The next morning, I jerked awake. The shrill cry of a hawk high overhead, pulling me into awareness. For a few moments, I listened carefully, imagining her lofty role. She cried one more time, then stopped. I sat up quickly and looked through the tent flap. The day was cloudy but warm, and a light breeze swayed the treetops. There was no sign of the hum. I pulled on a pair of shorts. Taking an ace bandage from my pack, I carefully wrapped the whole joint, working the ankle carefully, and feeling very little pain, then crawled out of the tent and stood up. After a few moments, I put weight on my foot and took a tentative step. The ankle felt weak, but if I limped slightly, it seemed to support me. I wondered, did Maya's procedure help, or was the ankle not hurt that badly? There was no way to know. Digging into my pack again, I retrieved a change of clothes, then grabbed the dirty dishes from the night before. Cautiously, I made my way back to the stream. When I located a place where I was shielded from view, I entered the water, finding it cold and refreshing. I lay there without thinking, trying to forget the anxiety rising in my gut, gazing out at the colors of the leaves above my head. Suddenly, I began to recall a dream from the night before. I was sitting on a rock. Something was happening. Will was there, and others. I vaguely remembered a field of blue and amber. I struggled a moment longer, but could recall nothing more. I noticed that the trees and bushes around me were suddenly amplified in appearance. Seconds later, I felt a pulling sensation in my solar plexus, and suddenly I was again streaking through the colors. When I stopped, the environment was pale blue and luminous, and Will was beside me. "Thank God you're back," he said, moving in closer. "You became so dense I couldn't find you." "What happened before?" I asked. "Why did the hum get so loud?"
"I don't know."
"Where are we now?"
"It's a particular level where dreams seem to take place."
I looked out into the blue. "You've been here before?"
"Yes, I came here before I found you at the falls, although at the time I didn't know why."
For a moment, we both surveyed the environment again. Then Will asked, "What happened to you when you went back?"
With excitement, I began to describe everything that had occurred, focusing first on Joel's forecast of civil collapse. Will listened intently, digesting every aspect of Joel's outlook. He was voicing the fear.
I nodded. "That's what I think." "Do you suppose all of what he said is really occurring?" I asked.
"I think the danger is that a lot of people are beginning to believe it's happening. Remember what the Ninth Insight said. As the spiritual renaissance progresses, it must overcome a polarization of fear."
I caught Will's eye. "I met someone else, a woman." Will listened as I described my experience with Maya, particularly the injury to my ankle and her healing procedures. "I think Maya is the woman in William's vision," I added, "the woman who is trying to stop the war with the Native Americans." A sudden movement in the environment drew our attention. Another group of souls seemed to be forming about 100 yards away.
"They are probably here to help someone with their dreaming," Will said.
I looked hard at him. "They help us dream?"
"Yes, in a way. Some other souls were here when you dreamed last night."
"How did you know about my dream?" "When you were jolted back into the physical, I tried to find you, but I couldn't. Then, when I waited, I began to see your face and moved here. The last time I came to this place, I couldn't quite grasp what was occurring, but now I think I understand what happens when we dream."
I shook my head, not comprehending.
He gestured out toward the souls. It apparently all happened synchronistically. These beings you see probably found themselves here just as I did earlier, by coincidence. And now they're probably waiting to see who comes by in their dream body. Suddenly the background hum grew louder, and I couldn't respond. I felt confused, dizzy. Will came closer to me, touching my back again.
"Stay with me," he said. "There's some reason we need to see this."
I struggled to clear my head, then noticed another form manifesting in the space beside the souls. At first, I thought other souls were appearing, but then I realized the formation was much larger than anything I'd seen before. I finally realized a whole scene was being projected in front of us, like a hologram, complete with characters, setting, and dialogue. A single individual seemed to be at the center of the action, a man, vaguely familiar. The person before us was Joel. As we watched, the scene began to unfold, like the plot of a movie. I strained to follow along, but my head was still foggy. I couldn't quite understand what was happening. After several minutes, the drama seemed to end, and everyone disappeared. "What was happening?" I asked. "The individual in the center of the scene was dreaming," Will said. "That was Joel, the man I told you about," I replied. Will turned to me in astonishment. "Are you sure?"
"Yes."
"Did you understand the dream he just had?"
"No, I couldn't quite get it. What happened?"
"The dream was about a war of some kind. He was fleeing a bomb-ravaged city with shells exploding all around him, running for his life, thinking of nothing but safety and survival. When he successfully evaded the horror and climbed a mountain to look back at the city, he suddenly remembered that his orders had been to meet another group of soldiers and supply a secret part to a new device which would make the enemy weapons inactive. To his horror, he now realized that because he had failed to show up, the group and the city were being systematically destroyed before his eyes."
"A nightmare," I commented.
"Yes, but it has meaning. When we dream, we unconsciously travel back to the sleep level, and other souls come and help us. But don't forget what dreams do. They clarify how to handle current situations in our lives.
The seventh insight says to interpret dreams by superimposing the plot of the dream against the real situation facing us in life." I turned and looked at Will. "But what role do the souls play?" As soon as I had asked that question, we began to move again. When we stopped, the light was shifting to a rich green, but I could observe beautiful waves of amber circulating around us. When I focused intently, the amber streaks became individual souls. I glanced at Will, who was smiling broadly. This location seemed to carry an increased mood of celebration and joy. As I watched the souls, several moved directly in front of us and closed together into a group. Their faces were broad and smiling, although still hard to focus on for any length of time.
"They're so full of love," I said.
"See if you can pick up on their knowledge," Will advised. When I focused on them with this intent, I realized that these souls were associated with Maya. In fact, they were ecstatic about her recent self-revelations, especially her understanding of the life preparation her father and mother had provided. They seemed to know that Maya had experienced a full sixth insight review and was on the verge of remembering why she had been born. Will and I glanced at each other. Then he began to stare intensely at the group, a look of surprise on his face.
"What are you seeing?" I asked.
He nodded toward them without breaking his gaze, and I focused on the soul group as well, trying to pick up on their knowledge again. After several moments, I began to see Maya. She was immersed in the green environment. Her features seemed slightly different and were glowing brightly, but I was absolutely certain it was her. As I focused on her face, a holographic image appeared in front of us, an image of Maya again in the time of the 19th century war, standing in a log cabin with several other people, excited about stopping the conflict. She seemed to sense that accomplishing such a feat was just a matter of remembering how to attain the energy. It could be done, if only the right people came together with a common intention, she thought. Most attentive was a young man who was richly dressed. I recognized him to be the large man who was later killed with her in the forest. Racing forward, the vision moved to her failed attempt to speak with the army leaders, and finally to the wilderness, where she and the young man were killed. As we watched, she awakened after her death in the afterlife and reviewed the lifetime, appalled at how single-mindedly, even naively, she had pursued her goal of stopping the war. She knew many of the others had been correct, but time wasn't right. We had not remembered enough of the afterlife knowledge to accomplish such a feat. Not yet. After the review, we saw her move into the green environment, surrounded by the same group of souls that were in front of us now. Amazingly, there seemed to be a common core expression in the faces throughout the group. At a certain level, beneath their features, the souls all resembled Maya. I glanced questioningly at Will. "This is Maya's soul group," he said.
"What do you mean?" I asked.
"It's a group of souls with whom she resonates closely," he said with excitement. "This makes perfect sense. One of the journeys I took before I found you was to another group who, in a way, looked like you. I think it was your soul group."
Before I could say anything, there was a movement in the soul group in front of us. Again, an image of Maya was emerging. She seemed to be standing quietly in front of an intense white light, similar to the one we had seen at William's life review. She was aware that something very profound was happening. Her ability to move around in the afterlife had diminished, and her attention was shifting toward Earth again. She could see her prospective mother, newly married, sitting on a porch, wondering if her health would hold up well enough to have a child. Maya was beginning to realize the great progress that could be achieved if she were born to this mother. The woman had deep fears about her own health, and so would generate an awareness of health issues very quickly in the mind of a child. It would be the perfect place to develop an interest in medicine and healing. Will caught my eye. "We're seeing what occurred when she began to contemplate her current life," he said. Maya's focus moved to the prospective father, sitting next to the woman on the swing. His mind was virtually exploding with research possibilities and exotic biological questions he knew had never been posed before, the relationship between inspiration and the immune system. With him, she would be able to work through her own tendency to delude herself. She would have to think for herself and become realistic, right from the beginning. As we watched, her vision proceeded past her anticipated birth and into what might happen in childhood. She saw a multitude of specific people arriving in her life at just the right moment to stimulate learning and medical experience. Her vision moved to the meeting of her clinic partner, and the establishment of a new model of healing. And then her vision revealed something else. She would be involved in a more global awakening. Before us, we saw her discovering of the insights, and then her discovery of a particular group, one of many independent groups, consisting of different backgrounds that would begin to gravitate together all over the world. These groups would remember who they were at a higher level, and be instrumental in overcoming the polarization. She suddenly saw herself engaged in important conversations with one particular man. He was large, athletic, capable, and dressed in army fatigues. To my amazement, I realized that she knew he was the man with whom she had been killed during the 19th century. I focused on him intently and received another shock. This was the same man I had seen in William's life review, the work colleague he had failed to help awaken. Finally, Maya's vision seemed to be over, and we could see her again in the green environment, still surrounded by her group. Now they were watching a scene on Earth. Apparently, her prospective parents had indeed decided to conceive a child, and were coming together in the very act of love that would ensure her conception. Maya's soul group had intensified in energy and now appeared as a large, whitish swirl of moving amber, drawing its intensity from the bright light in the background. I could sense the energy myself
as a deeply felt, almost orgasmic level of love and vibration. Down below, the couple embraced, and at the moment of orgasm, a whitish-green energy seemed to flow from the light, passing through Maya and her soul group, and entering into the couple. With an orgasmic rush, the energy came through their bodies toward each other, pushing the sperm and egg toward their faithful union. As we watched, we could see the moment of conception and the miraculous joining of the two cells into one. Slowly at first, and then more rapidly, the cells began to divide and differentiate, finally forming the shape of a human being. When I looked at Maya, I realized that with every cell division, she became more hazy and out of focus. Finally, as the fetus matured, she disappeared from view completely. Her soul group remained. More knowledge seemed to be available on what we had just witnessed, but I lost concentration and missed it. Then, suddenly, the soul group itself was gone, and Will and I were left staring at each other. He seemed terribly excited. "What were we watching?" I asked. "It was the whole process of Maya's birth into her current lifetime," Will replied. "We got to see it all. Her awareness, the prospective parents, what she felt might be accomplished, and then the actual way she was drawn into the physical dimension at conception." I nodded for Will to continue. "Did you notice how it worked?" he asked. "The act of lovemaking opens up a portal from the afterlife into the earthly dimension. The soul groups seem to exist in a state of extreme love even beyond what you and I can experience. Extreme to the point that it feels orgasmic in nature. Sexual culmination creates an opening into the afterlife, and what we experience as orgasm is just a glimpse of the afterlife level of love and vibration as the portal is opened and the energy rushes through, potentially bringing in a new soul. We watched that happen. Sexual union is a holy moment in which a part of heaven flows into the earth." I nodded, thinking about the implications of what we had seen, then said, "Maya seemed to know how her life could turn out if she was born to these particular parents." "Yes, apparently, before we are born, each of us experiences a vision of what our life can be, complete with reflections on our parents and our tendencies going in to engage in particular control dramas, even how we might work through these dramas with these parents, and go on to be prepared for what we want to accomplish." "I saw most of that," I said, "but it seemed strange. Based on what she told me about her real life, her pre-life vision was more ideal than what really happened." "But that makes sense," Will said. "The vision apparently is an ideal guide for what our highest self intends to happen in life. The best case scenario, so to speak, if everyone were following their intuitions perfectly. What actually occurs is an approximation of this vision, the best everyone can do under the actual circumstances. But all this is more tense inside information about the afterlife that clarifies our spiritual experience of Earth, particularly the perception of coincidences and how that sense of flow really operates. When we have an intuition or a dream to pursue a particular course in our lives, and we follow this guidance, and certain events transpire that feel like magic coincidences, we feel more alive and excited. The events feel destined, as though we knew they were supposed to happen. What we just saw puts all this into a higher perspective. When we have an intuition, a mental image of a possible future, we're actually getting flashes of memory of our birth vision, what we wanted to be doing with our lives at that particular point in our journey.
But how does our soul group fit in?
They share our birth visions and follow us through life, and afterwards stay with us while we review what happened. They act as a reservoir for our memories, maintaining the knowledge of who we are as we evolve. And apparently, when we're in the afterlife and one of them is born into the physical dimension, we act in the same capacity toward them. We become part of the soul group that supports them. "So the soul groups are always sending us energy," I said, "and hoping we will remember our birth visions?"
"That's right.
And that's why Maya's group was so happy?
Will's expression grew more serious. They were happy because she was remembering why she was born to her particular parents and how her life experiences had prepared her for a career in healing. But this was only the first part of her birth vision. She still had more to remember.
I saw the part when she was meeting again in this life with the man with whom she was killed in the 18th century. But there were other parts that I couldn't understand.
How much of that did you get?
Not all of it. There was more about the rising fear. It confirmed that she's part of the group of seven that William saw coming back. And she saw the group able to remember some kind of larger vision that connected with stopping the fear and whatever is happening in the valley, Will said.